we earn our living from a system that's heavily financed by federal and state grants to education. And consequently, we are very much enamored of a certain kind of federal and state spending, welfare, but particularly uplifting welfare. Welfare that enlarges people's horizons and brings them new opportunities. We are very much opposed to any kind of interference with academic freedom, and we extend that to mean any kind of external review of what we do in our classrooms. And you talk to college professors are a certain kind of liberal. I put it in quotes because it's a very funny kind of a liberal. It's a knee-jerk liberal. The great majority of college professors, you can predict their positions on certain issues, and they tend to, I don't want to exaggerate this, but they begin with a kind of a mindset that they're pro-government, particularly when government is spending money on welfare, especially educational-like things, and they're very anti-government when it's interfering with freedom of talk and speech, because that could get down to them. They're very individualistic because they're a place yet in the college classroom is a place where a guy is still supposed to be king, where he'd get up there and be an individual, do his own thing. And, the absent-minded professor, we all admire him. The radical professor. You can wear a beard and be a college professor, You can't do that other places. Well, I don't know whether I've answered, but I've tried to illustrate. It's a hard thing to illustrate. The thesis is that the way in which people earn their living shapes their values, including their political values. No. There isn't that much difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. But I would say most college professors ought to be Democrats on the basis of that, because the Democrats tend more to support those goals, and most college professors are Democrats.
Would that be the reason then why college professors
need
less than so many? Because they're
leading
from government and they're leading our country
down leftist road? I don't think they're leading our country down the leftist road.
Well, they're saying our young people
Some people think the young people are leading the professors down the leftist road. Well, if by leftist road you mean, what do you mean by leftist road?
Socialism.
Well, most college professors are not socialists; they're anti-socialists.
But in the extent that government should look through for all the answers.
This would be a good point to continue that college professors, see, because they work with their minds and solve problems in their heads, they have a great competence and expertise, and so they like to say, let's get somebody up there at the top who can solve the problem, and maybe he'll call me in as a consultant. They have a tremendous amount of confidence in the ability of, more confidence than most people in the ability of governments to solve problems, because they see governments as operated by staff made up of people like college professors, intellectuals. And intellectuals are, since they're intellectuals, make their living being intellectuals, they know intellectuals are smart and honest. And so, I was always a little worried about a question like that, but I think it is true. If you define the leftist road as pushing toward more government solutions of problems, bigger government, I think there is a real bias in the college teaching ranks in favor of that sort of thing. And I think that it's induced largely, not exclusively, I don't believe in anything is exclusively induced by anything, but largely induced by the way in which they earn their living.
It is true, though, that every president has as his front people the cabinet, but has as his chief advisor I mean, his top advisors, the ones on which he depends the most for expertise in these areas, college professors.
I don't know, Will. College professors have a lot of influence. Yeah. Very frequently through influencing cabinet members.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It varies with the president. I've seen, for example, that Nixon is far too much influenced by his attorney general, and would really be well advised to listen a little more to the college professors. But
I saw a TV program one week on certain college presidents having gotten together to disown certain other of their colleagues who were apparently the undercover chief advisors to the president on foreign policy.
Yeah.
Now, is that true, isn't it? You know.
Well, I don't know. Foreign policy particularly, it's difficult to say who's making the decisions. That's necessarily shrouded in secrecy. And Walt Rostow and a few people like this have caught a lot of guff from the academic community. And I think, by the way, the academic community is betraying its liberal credentials in doing that. And I think Walt Rostow, you can disagree with him, but the kind of personal attacks on him don't do us any credit. Well, you're not limited not asking questions. You know, you're supposed to. Since when? I mean, when it? I'm not familiar with that. Familiar with the lumber industry? When you say it's dead, is it just? I want to know whether it just died recently or.
Last 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Last 2.5 years is coming almost complete. Mm-hmm. But the thing here being that money is. I think a lot of people assume that money is created by the government, which is not. Money is created within the business, through the banks, through businesses, and whatnot, and. There's a lot of music, as Will alluded to the other night, the staccato of the air hammer. And this is music of the society we live in. Part of it is filling. Another part is turning down. Part of it is dressing. But when you dry up one segment of this, you affect all of the rest of it. And so everybody sitting back here, slackly twiddling their thumbs and not doing part of what they should be doing. And we go back into the game and we will see, because of in the next, I'd say the next decade, we will see a complete reversal because of the abuse of the power that these groups have had. The abuse of their position will bring about their downfall. And until they fall down, we've got some problems. But business can invest only that money which it creates in terms of profit, whatever you want to do. And investments that are made in the economic sense of what is known as the opportunity cost, which I can 90% probability to make 30% per year on this investment, or 50% probability to make 500%. But I've only got $1 billion, or $100,000, or $10,000 to invest this year. And where do I invest? I'm going to invest the whole thing. And where am I going to invest? And some groups are very, very influential in drying up the circulation.
Won't the investment then just go somewhere else?
No, the investment is made. I'm going to sell all our state managers and churches. They invest $2 billion a year in new plants and facilities. $2 billion a year. Today, they're buying 30% less new plants. Oh, 30% less new plants than they did 5 years ago. And so they're going to invest the same amount of money. And they just isn't going to get as much. We've got a green factor today.
Would you, I'm going to ask another question. Your statement that government doesn't create money.
No, government doesn't create money.
I want to be sure what you mean by that. You don't mean that the government is not, well, let me put a positive statement. The federal government does control the amount of the means of payment that is in existence in the country at any time. You agree with that? You meant something else?
They maintain control to the extent that they can limit the amount of credit that the banks can extend.
All right, which is money, of course.
Which is money, but the government itself does not create this money, does not create this credit that these banks give out.
Okay, but the government can control the amount of it.
Yeah, on a supervision. They have influence over it, yeah, but they are not the ones.
They can control it.
Yeah, but there's a difference between control and creation.
And the government can decide that there shall, within very narrow limits, how much money there shall be in the country at any time. Well, I don't want to hang up on a technical.
No.
I didn't know what you were.
I mean, they're not both, yeah.
I can't let. Are you an economist?
No.
I mean, you know some things here about art. You use some terms even, but okay. I'm a teacher of economics, and I can't let somebody say that the federal government does not control the money supply because it doesn't. Okay, they use the mechanism of the private banks to get it created. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
The private bank or business. And if we watch the present period of banking laws that we're going in, then the whole thing is going to go upside down.
So we make a distinction here between wealth and money. There's such a thing as production, and that's wealth. If you don't have production, you don't have money either. The production goes down because costs go up and all that, and they don't see the profit back anymore. That's what the money situation is.
This has an effect on the money situation, but it's like the antithesis that if you want to maximize profits, you minimize costs. And these two are not synonymous in the business world. A lot of business people think they are. The way to maximize an organization's profits is to minimize costs. And these two are so far apart in reality. I can minimize the organization I work in, and we can minimize our costs. We can cut our costs to zero. We can close the front door. We fulfill the contractual obligations we now have, and boom, we minimize our costs. Our costs go right to zero.
Well, listen, can we come back to the essential point you made? You said that now that, and maybe...
Some groups have a very strong influence.
The labor unions, and you seem to be focusing on the building trades unions. I wrong about that? Yeah, building trades unions have a lot of power to do a lot of damage in our society.
Yeah. I mean, anybody living in the Midwest felt the truck strike this year. Down in the delicatessen in our area, it depends on trucks to carry in material from Chicago to Moline. The department stores felt that the racks were empty, and the materials, when it ended and some of the materials came in, you couldn't sell over the cost you would have if you had them at the right season, because now summer is here and people aren't, you know, buying the spring things, so everything is marked down. And a lot of businesses felt the trucks like pretty badly.
But that's what you're saying in this discussion, you call the teamsters. They're not trying to get into great figures in California. But it is a construction business.
Aren't these things just a little off the point from what we were on? These things are having a direct economic effect upon the country and possibly influence the course that governments take. But they're not exercising any direct control over the government, which I think was what the original thesis was here. It shapes the thinking of the people that are in the groups and the people that must react to these groups, and possibly they vote one way and do something thing, but the labor unions are not exercising any control over the government. And causing the government to take certain policies, which perpetuates it, nor are the teacher union by way of their strike exercising any direct control over the government. I don't believe it.
I believe that Nixon's presidency, 5 months old anti-inflationary, actually was a direct outgrowth of the increased cost. Trying to put a lid on this and inflation something.
Well, this is an economic effect of what has happened, and it's not a reaction.
But a politician's reaction to a stimulus is a political action.
Well, I disagree with that, but it's not in response to a direct appeal from labor to do something. It's not a
we're quarreling here now about what we're going to talk about, and I really don't know how to. I'm responsible for the confusion, I think, because I didn't make that clear whether we're talking about who exercises control over the government. I jumped, I guess, back and forth between who has control over government and who has power to affect social change. I really wanted to ask who has power to affect social change, the broader question, some people think that, or they talk as if social change is affected primarily through getting the government to do things, and there's one reason why I focused on government control. So I don't know, I think we've got to let this come in, and let me just say that I was not suggesting that. Remember, I did say that people's values are shaped by the way in which they earn their living. People organized on the basis of the way in which they earn their living can do one heck of a lot of damage to our society. I don't think they can do much that's constructive, but they can do an awful lot of damage. And the damage that it may be extremely difficult for the government or anybody else to undo. But mm-hmm.
Is this to be interpreted, am I hearing an anti-union statement at this point, Paul, or?
Not the way in which most people define unions, as made up of wage earners. I'm thinking of, it would include Adam Smith's notion, people engaged in the same profession seldom meet together even for lunch without it winding up in a conspiracy against the public good. If I had to pick out somebody to jump on with both feet, I'd pick on educators first. I think they've really done a lot of screwing up our society by the narrow parochial point of view that they think serves their interests, which they've been effective in foisting upon the public. I am anti-union, kind of, really, I'll admit it. For craft unions of people organized because they're doing a particular thing. I'm not anti-industrial union very much because I don't think they've been very effective, but I think they've done a very important job of providing a grievance machinery in factories and large industrial plants, whereby people who otherwise would tend to be too subject to the whims of a foreman, something like that, can secure some kind of due process. I think that's important. And if you take something like the grape strike, I'm really of two minds on that, because I see that grape strike as, what is it, really open a bag of worms here, or the bag of grapes. I see that grape strike as, on its constructive side, an attempt by a group of people to assert their importance, their significance, by gaining some power, power to make other people listen to them. But insofar as it's an attempt, just plain old unionism, which it isn't for Cesar Chavez, but that's the way a lot of people interpret it. I'm against it. I think that for agricultural workers to organize into unions, well, it'll be beneficial to some agricultural workers and harmful to the majority of agricultural workers, and very quickly wind up an increase in the rate of technological change. Fewer people will be working in agriculture.
Okay, but you said you were going to let Dexter back in. I'm intrigued by, you know, at least what I saw building up to a rather interesting exchange, you know, at the moment that we cut it off.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Shoot the moderator.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back to this. I mean, I don't hear any strong dissent from his view that there are certain unions, especially construction unions, broadly defined to include Teamsters, who are messing this country up badly. And you agree? And if so, what are we going to do about it? Now the question becomes, who's in charge and can stop this sort of thing?
Who's in charge and can stop this sort of thing? I don't know if there's anyone in charge. I know the conspiracy is what can stop it. I am aware of the conspiracy of what can stop it. Great biasing that has gone on within the construction industry, the great disparity of fruits of social effort versus what we're taking into because most of us who are involved in the construction industry, we look for continuing a certain amount of the growth natural products, always in the terms of new plants and facilities. I have to work with one of the larger engineering construction organizations to read up the plan. But it holds true to the small individual building houses and running down and up. What is going on here, and the statistics are very interesting, is that the organized labor percentage of the total investment, new plants and facilities, is going down each year. The average percentage is taking a very severe drop. The absolute dollar volume awarded to contractors, to union contractors, and we're a union contractor, so we employ in the state, we employ primarily union labor. We don't have any non-union employees in the construction sector of the state. Once we get outside of 48 states, or outside of 50 states, we don't have any union.
Not that we're trying to avoid
using union labor. We're trying to come up with a means for our survival.
Yeah,
and if this means using somebody other than union labor, it's fine. Let's take something that the basic labor union was built on the premise that you have to be in a field of endeavor for an X number of years, 5 number of years, 15 years, because to become a journeyman. It's because we didn't know how to teach people to do things. And because along the lines that Will has been talking about here, we assume that a certain group has superior knowledge of the techniques of building the plant. And so we set up, it takes 5 years to become a journeyman, electrician, carpenter, bill wreck, whatever it happens to be, it's not much different. We know, and I say we, speaking of the organization I work with, we know from experience that we can take anyone anywhere in the world, and with somebody who wants to teach them, we can make a very, very good electrician or a very good welder in a matter of weeks, in 10 to 15 weeks, we can make a man a very good construction trade. And so this myth that takes so long to become product in the art of construction is beginning to disappear.
I think that's probably true in a lot of jobs. I know from my own experience that we often train people with fairly technical jobs and with fairly
What's going to happen? What are we going to do about it? I hear you saying that there are forces at work. You said conspiracy. I don't think you really meant that, but there are forces at work to reduce their power by drying up their job opportunities. You know, the more money they demand, the fewer people they let in, the higher will be the price of construction. There will be a shift away from the production of things where their labor is needed, a shift toward substituting machinery for labor and prefabricated houses maybe and that sort of thing. And you think that that's going to solve the problem?
Well, it's not going to solve some of the problems, the shift away. The other one is the large enough segment of the construction industry moving away from dealing with the construction trade unions and actually going out of the banks, as we call it, out of the gate, basically job hires and hiring people off the street to be training folks and everything else.
I have a question about that. Now, there's a certain confusion as to exactly what the status of the labor union is under the law, because, in other words, you hear about how a company has a contract with the union. You know, can the company, after the contract expires, they go out on strike and demand, you know, so much percent increase in wages. Now, the company has always sort of seemed to be negotiating with the union, and there seems to be no alternative. In other words, the company you don't hear about companies going out and in the middle of a strike hiring, firing all of the union employees and we just forget it, you know, we're going to go out and hire all the union people now. Is there something against the law in there? I mean, is this illegal?
Probably, yeah, it probably is. It's very hard. So the law, the basic law of the land, which covers all workers roughly in interstate commerce, and that's so broadly defined as to include almost everybody, is that employers may not engage in certain unfair labor practices. Now, an unfair labor practice includes discriminating against a worker for union activity. So the law really allows an employer to lay off striking workers and replace them with others. But in practice, you know, it's very hard to do. You know, if you've got 137 employees, rather skilled, and you really need at least 120 to operate, it's going to be very hard to get 120 new people all of a sudden and bring them in. You're not going to find them, even in a labor area as large as Los Angeles. So what you would probably have to do is begin firing some of them. And you almost certainly would get cited for an unfair labor practice because they would claim you're picking on us because we're the leaders of the strike, we're the real gung-ho people. In effect, though not in intention,
okay,
the law
prohibits it. You don't have, you know, nobody is working. You know, you're not let's say that the prospect may be, you know, that you're, you know, there's maybe years will go by before the union will ever agree to work for you again, you know, because there's that much difference. There's no prospect in sight of a settlement. Seems to me that a company in that case would be better off, even if they could only hire one or two at a time, build up to it. In other words, just go out and search. And they don't do it, and I always assume that there must be some law against it.
Well, don't forget, there are costs to operating besides labor costs. You hire one or two at a time, you're going to get almost nothing done, but you're going to continue to incur huge overhead costs.
Okay. Yeah. In other words, it's mainly economic then. Yeah.
And there also is, let's face it, there also is the discreet use of violence. The building trades unions have been effective in using violence to prevent this kind of thing, the replacing of strikers. You know, if you do manage to get a little work out and make a little profit, it goes very quickly. If your insurance gets canceled because your building starts burning, your trucks get overturned, so most employers find it just not worth it.
That brings up another question. I was talking about the cars and the union. A lot of times you talk about violence. Now, it seems to me that this could also be construed as an unfair labor practice. Is it just that the NLRB won't do anything?
No, the problem is that only unions... Employers can commit unfair labor practices, and unions can commit unfair labor practices, but employees cannot. Moreover, a guy who bombs a truck does not usually put a notice in the paper that he did it. I mean, he's committed a criminal act. He'd go to prison for it. But you cannot cite the union for an unfair labor practice because an employee bombed the truck. Have you ever seen, after these bombings, the union always comes out with a statement. We do not approve of that sort of thing. Although we can certainly understand why he did it.
Well, that thing happened in the Portland, Oregonian, when the bombed some trucks, blew them up, and of course there was no association.
Yeah, and though I don't want to condone this, it might be helpful. This seems to be pretty much an anti-union group, so I think I feel safe in suggesting that when you... Remember, everybody's values are molded by the way he earns his living, I suggested. And if you see another guy taking a job that you think belongs to you while you are out on strike trying to defend just a decent standard of living and reasonable working conditions, workers never believe they're asking for anything unreasonable. You know, you can get pretty angry, you know, and a man's got a right to defend. Now, I'm not condoning the violence, but I think it helps a lot to understand why it occurs.
I'm just going to bring up one more point as to why plants cannot continue operating when one union goes on strike. And that's because of the other unions that do supply the plants with the materials and that will generally honor the picket line. The other unions also exert pressure on the plant to help close it down, like in the fact of the Minneapolis school teachers today. My dad's a janitor. And they got permission from the union, from the teachers union, to stay and work. But if they hadn't gotten that permission, their union would have told them to go on strike.
think it's just sort of a matter of honoring the picket lines off.
I'd like to ask a question that requires a prophetic answer. If these trade unions keep on stepping up their demand for wages, like the election of the workers' friends, or the pilots' union, they have to bring in ships, you know, they have a pretty big concession that asks the labor, you know, the dispute. If that keeps on, without being curbed in time, what will be the eventual outcome? And here's a group that you just have to do a village. You can't be long on the creek. But then you start asking for $10 or $15 or $20 an hour, because if you know that it's the appetite price, what will happen?
International Brother of Electrical Workers now get about $27 an hour in New York City. That's an old figure. It's probably higher now.
Nearly 30.
Yeah. So they're up there. And the answer with what's going to happen is a continuation of the things he's described. There is one of the reasons why many people notice that Americans move better than they sit. That is to say, when we're in our automobiles, we're more fashionably surrounded than when we're in our homes, on average, is because of this factor, that unions have not been as effective in curtailing the growth of the transportation industry as they have been in curtailing the growth of the construction industry. You look, these things happen slowly over time, but there is, you may think the country's overbuilt already, you know, but the truth is there are fewer buildings, poorer quality buildings, residences and commercial buildings in this country today because of these activities of the labor union. That's what happens. It's just resources get reallocated. They make one product, construction, so expensive that people will only buy that product when they really feel they gotta have it. And they will tend to shift their expenditures off to something else. This constant search for substitutes.
Do-it-yourselfers.
Well, yeah, the do-it-yourself movement comes along, and more people paint their own houses and bang their own nails. But of course, that's not an option available to businesses. You know, you're not going to send the managers out to erect the new insurance office.
But would you agree then, to the extent that the individual cannot control his appetite that pay for maybe more wealth than he ought to have, to that extent he's asking the government to regulate wages, prices, and so forth, and affect bringing socialism?
I wouldn't say that, because in the first place, I don't know how much a person ought to have. And it seems to me most of us ask for all we can get. And we try to get in a position where what we can get is an awful lot. And we always believe that it's really our due. I'm not trying to sound cynical about this. The capacity of the human animal for rationalizing a lucky break is infinite. and so you got in as a, you were lucky, you know, your father was a carpenter, your uncle, and so he recommended you for the union at 16 when you dropped out of high school anyway, and you just went, and boy, before you knew it, you were upper middle class, you know, and now you look back and you say, but, you know, I'm a very skilled person, and you talk about your expectations. Clark Kerr, who, before he became infamous at the University of California as a college president, was a very distinguished labor arbitrator, was once called in to arbitrate a construction trades dispute in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I may have Chattanooga National turn around, but he went to Chattanooga, and he found that there was a strike. Group was striking, not because their wages were low. They thought they were all right, but they were lower than what the workers were getting in Nashville for the same thing. So he felt, well, all right, you know, the arbitrators finally have to play God. He handed down a decision. They got what they wanted. He was called in a bit later to arbitrate in Nashville for workers who were demanding a restoration of the time-honored differential. You know, what are you going to say? I don't think that it helps very much to talk about the greed of people, because we're all greedy. I think it's more helpful to ask, well, when greed gets out of bounds and creates serious problems for the rest of us, what kinds of political or social economic checks can we put on people's power so that their appetites, which always seem to be voracious, don't make us suffer so much. And here, I think that we ought to, with the construction trades, we ought to ask the question, on what meat doth this our Caesar feed? And he has fed on the meat of government privilege. The laws, the pro-labor laws that this country has enacted, beginning in 1932 roughly, but then 1935 primarily, and the subsequent laws reforming this have had a strong discriminatory bias in favor of the construction trade. The so-called Landrum-Griffin reforms, which were the last major overhaul of federal legislation, contained, I thought, some excellent provisions to prevent certain kinds of abuses of power by unions that were practiced almost exclusively by the construction trades. And then they threw in a little clause saying, but the construction trades are exempt from this provision. I think that when you find a group, an interest group like this, with power really to do serious damage to the society, you will always find that they are operating with some kind of special grant of privilege conferred upon them and enforced by the government.
The electrician in the state of New York, you save $36,000 a year. We're talking local situation.
Same thing is true for the college teachers and the doctors.
getting back to this, what do you do about this, though? I mean, would it solve everything just if we deleted that clause in the Landrum-Griffin Act? Is that the end?
I think that would help. You were talking about the sympathetic strike, weren't you? It's rather hard to draft legislation against a sympathetic strike, you know, when because you can't, you can draft laws that forbid unions from doing things, but you don't really, do you, want to draft a law telling a worker he must work at a certain job? That seems to be against the 13th Amendment. So as we try to draft laws that prohibit unions from doing things, we often find they're ineffective because, well, like good old John L. Lewis. Interesting. John L. Lewis would call the mine workers out on strike, and the government would go and get an injunction, and they would say, John L. Lewis, you get them back on the job in the mines, or you start getting a fine of $100,000 a day. And John L. Lewis would say, gentlemen, our union honors the injunction. Therefore, the union is telling you to stop the strike. And every worker knew John L. Lewis didn't mean it. And what does he do? You can't put John. One judge got so angry, he did try to throw Lewis in jail and fined him $1.5 million. But the Supreme Court threw it out. You can't. There's a problem.
Yeah, I think John L. Lewis is a good example of what happened. Take a look at the coal miners. They were unionized.
Yep.
What happened? That is the most highly recognized industry in the world, except for the auto refinery. Mm-hmm. An average coal mine has an investment of $39,000 per man in plant and equipment. The oil industry has $50,000 per man.
When the present labor legislation was originally drafted, the United Mine Workers was perhaps the strongest union in the country. So strong that it founded the CIO. It started the United Automobile Workers. It started the United, particularly the United Steel Workers. The first president of the United Steel Workers was given by John L. Lewis. He was the vice president of the United Mine Workers. About 600,000 members they had. Last year they stopped publishing membership figures. They were so embarrassed. They've been holding their published figures, I believe, 100,000 for years, but way below that. There's almost no union left. And who burns coal? When was the last time you saw a piece of coal?
It should be burning coal anyway.
Well, or yeah, but maybe it's a good thing. Maybe ye meant evil against me, but the Lord brought it to good to stop all that dirt from getting into the air. But it is a good example of what happens when a union effectively controls wages and just pushes them up.
The great benefit that came from the union, from the United Mine Workers, though, was this was the first place that we got decent safety regulations and governmental inspection and enforcing the safety regulations, which is carried across into almost every other segment of the industry, of any industry, manufacturing, construction, whatever it happens to be.
And I say, I'm glad you mentioned that, because in all this anti-union talk here, we might reflect on the fact that though they don't do a real red-hot job, maybe, unions may be doing as good a job as anybody of speaking for that unorganized guy out there who's called the consumer, and who's the victim of all sorts of carelessness and slipshod government policies. Unions do go and testify for the consumer when bills come up, so maybe in a small way they play a kind of a watchdog role for...
Well, it's part of the checks and balances. I think you check that completely unbalanced as a balance
for someone. By the way, though, it's the industrial unions which have been, you know, not the craft unions like the building trades, it's the industrial unions like the United Automobile Workers and the United Steel Workers and the United Electrical Workers that have been, that's not the same thing as the International Brotherhood of Electric Workers, who have done the most of this sort of thing, you know, who have campaigned for legislation that would affect the consumer and the housewife and so on. The industrial union, probably because they don't have as much power to affect their members' positions through collective bargaining, they tend to turn to social legislation.
But, see, Paul, you know, I was just almost, I wanted to yell, maybe go outside and find a few workers, you know, and bring them in here, because it, you know, it seems if they're in here, they're so outnumbered and inundated by owner, manager, employer rhetoric that, you know, that they don't seem to even talk. But quite frankly, Walter Unther is one of my heroes, and I think rightly so. He's one of the visible topographies of what happens, you know, when a man sets his mind to change something, to make it creative and positive as opposed to anything else. He walked and talked very closely with Dr. King during his lifetime, and practically underwrote much of his program. So, you know, you really want to yell at this point, at least in the area of industrial unions, you know, is that somebody ought to say a word for them, because I think that they have enhanced and ennobled American life to a great extent. They are by and large not hard hats, and they are not to be equated, at least in always, with buildings and trades people.
Oh. Yeah, well, I did dissociate them. I hope it was clear.
I think somewhere or other, Paul started thinking, like, give me a hard look when you brought the positions in along with the drawing professors here. And the thought that comes to mind is I think that in terms of economic, getting back to our original question, you know, who shapes the policy of the nation? Anybody does. I think something is happening to these special interest groups, whether they be unions or college professors or physicians or what have you, plant managers. I think that something is happening in a reevaluation of the values upon which society has let people have these positions of privilege or lack of privilege. Almost as if, in an economic sense, Jacksonian democracy is coming to the fore. And I think this is what we as physicians are finding ourselves caught in. And you as a collegiate faculty find yourself in. the position of social and economic, but particularly social purpose of a quarter of this group is now under attack. And the bulwark of acceptance and public regard that we have run on in the past is being undermined, and in many instances, I think, purposely so. In the media, and I don't know if it's a good place for me, this is not kind of argument, but it is. And I think great changes have been about in our whole society, and one of the changes is that the special interest group more and more finds that its ability to exert pressure is no longer on as much on the point of privilege as it is on the point of numbers. And if you can't swing the numbers, or at least whatever it takes to swing the number of votes, you know, you're not going to be a court for everything. Am I right? Or am I wrong?
I agree with you, yeah. I think there's a growing tide of public fed upness with special interest groups, and that's in part the multiplication of media, you know, so we get kind of a new muckraking era, but a lot of things get out in the open and get discussed, you know. I think that's good and a healthy thing, the special interest groups claim the privilege of being examined. And maybe that's the way change takes place. But if that's the way change takes place, it takes place slowly. And that's frustrating. We don't like to be frustrated. So we scream, gonna do something about it.
You know, I have something I'd like to air. I don't know whether I'm really completely off base, but the idea of the chicken in the pot, a color television set in every home, this philosophy, I didn't realize when I first heard this, Paul, but now I just really disagree with it. Because everybody doesn't work the same. The productivity level is not the same. They can't earn enough money to buy certain things the same as their neighbor. The automobile again. Credit, the media is available to get this purchase possible, this acquisition. A purchase really, theoretically, is when the guy makes the last payment. And I think it causes a great many frustrations in this country. I guess it's partially the fault of the media, the advertising people, to create the image, the discontent, the frustrations. My point I'm trying to make is an unclear one. It's just something that I see that just causes just problem after problem.
What would you do about it?
I don't know.
I know we do a lot of that.
I don't know. I just merely throw it out. I see this. This was just touched upon the other day. It was touched upon again here. And you can't point your finger at the union. You can't point your. I mean, you know, a clear cut zap. There it is, right there. Cut it out. And you can't point it at you. You can't point it at the physicians or the finance industry, which I represent, or will. Well, it's something he said just before lunch. He said that the genes came with us when we came over from Europe to deal with a different problem. But maybe it's as complex as this. And I don't know. But all I know that everybody's capacity to earn, capacity to learn and to produce is not the same. And I'm very confused because I have this basic feeling that what you put in, you're going to get out of it. And every guy can't put in the same amount. You have different abilities. But they all expect the same result, the same amount to come out. Maybe I'm off base. I don't know.
You're putting a lot of value into the
material. No, I maybe I'm just...
I mean, everybody, not just you. I mean,
doesn't
exactly...
Well, that might be, but I think it goes farther than this. I think it's the idea that Maybe one guy is a little more of a creative producer. Let's go back when they were trapping. And it became more of a staple to go out and exist. And a woman who was more creative in terms of a loom. Back to the era beyond the chrome and the radio and the affluence. And I don't think that they had this philosophy then. Maybe,
they didn't have a philosophy then because they weren't as, well, going back to, they weren't a different lump rung on the ladder at that point in time because we were by the thing. The thing here is that let's go back to the first chapter of Genesis where we're told to have dominion over. And one of the necessary, or not necessary, but one of the byproducts of existence came up to be chrome and Ubuntu and one of that the idiot stream. I blame the news media for a lot for biasing the source and whatnot in the story. I think it had some of the views that Will expressed here last year been reported during the watch riot. These things would have been a lot more than good and whatnot, but you could never get this to look at that. Try to do this kind of commentary, but that isn't what they felt like people wanted to hear. But if we go on the basis that people receive reward the system on the basis of their creative contribution, we would go back to the warlord's act of society almost overnight, because we're in a situation that only probably 5 to 10% of the producing community are actually in the process of producing. And the rest of them are more or less mechanized robots sitting there. They're not exercising ingenuity. They're putting a nut on and they're torquing it up, or they're putting three leaves in here, or they're putting this plate and spoon in this box and this kind of thing. And who's to measure the relative value of washing the dishes versus the value of manufacturing the dishes and whatnot? And there has to be some normalizing. It's just where is the balance between the individual receiving on the basis of what he put into it versus the reception on the basis of a certain amount of normalization.
Yeah, it seems to me that in a society where there's a great struggle for existence, that perhaps something like this carries more weight. I'm not sure even in a fluent society that you can completely discard the notion that people ought to be rewarded according to what they put in, but I wonder if, at least in a society in which, theoretically at least, we can satisfy everybody's basic needs and maybe even make life more than just drudgery, and we can, make it seem like worth living, if we should go strictly on this basis, or if we shouldn't be able to guarantee somebody a certain level of existence. Because even if somebody is a relative non-contributor, maybe he just doesn't contribute anything at all, it isn't always his fault that he can't. And the person as a human being here, maybe you can say, well, I shouldn't have been doing anything like that, but you're here now, and you're going to say this person, we don't contribute.
Go back to the other realization, in the technological age that we are, we don't need the workforce we have to produce the goods and services that we're not producing. And it would be what I very firm believer in, what I call benevolent nepotism. A guy helped the organization get to this point, but if he can't contribute to the success of the organization from now on, he should be retired at full salary and kept from impeding the decision-making process for the progress of the organization and for the good of society.
Something counts.
No, but I mean, you're to a point that we spend, 20 years in the educational system and roughly 30 years in the production environment, and then hopefully we spend 20 or 30 years in retirement. We're perfectly capable of running people in the production environment about 15 years. And then what are you going to do? The old value system of thrift and hard work are the only two virtues you can know now are a waste of the ready reserve account. Bank of America, you see the rest of them getting ready from the thrift, and once all the end of the month, they have to do that.
One problem we face society is that, in a sense, our workforce on the production end may be greater than demand, whereas the need in other areas of our society, in terms of the service-centered areas and so forth, still comes fast and prime for members.
Yeah, there are, I want to underline that, there are lots of things crying to be done in our society that aren't done because we say, haven't got the people. Maybe we should retire some of these useless wheels that are just gumming up the decision process for business and send them out to run daycare centers. We could use people in the nursery here at Holden Village. And how about down there on a bridge?
Is it true, though, Paul, that there are a couple of relatively new industries which I think have not only taken the country by storm, but the world by storm? I'm thinking right away of the one industry represented, at least until recently, by the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. The cost of the production of and the cost of the maintenance of those highly dangerous electrified things that, you know, that the younger world played around with. I know this is of interest to some of us because that's been one of the few areas in which we can have millionaires no contest, you know. And then all of a sudden they horned in on our thing and started to make more than us with it. That one, and it would be real interesting, you know, to have an economist, you know, take a look at that. I don't know if you have or not. And along with that, maybe the cosmetic industry and a few of the others. Then I contrast that with, you know, it seems to me that, you know, this great cry that we could not do it, without. Buildings, you know, we talk about, you know, if something happened to that, we'd be in trouble. Or if war stopped, you know, we'd be in trouble. Seems to me that there's at least minimal inversion of the order of priorities with some of the new money-making industries at this point. And some of the general folk may be providing some outlet or some alternative, you know, to the sort of terrible situation which these other modes of progress have gotten into. I don't know, have you got some reaction to that?
No.
Okay.
Baffles me. I won't react to that, but I'll react to the area that you're talking. I think we are going to have to, whether we want to or not, if we are to avoid social chaos that will make the things we're going through now look like a picnic. We are going to have to learn to love life with far fewer things. And learn to take delight in many of the beautiful things that happen and that are, which we haven't even learned to see.
Is there any reasonable expectation that would ever happen? It seems to me the trend is so well set in one direction.
I think there are forces at work now in our society that are helping to make it happen. Such things as kids making their own music. And when I was a kid, everybody was told you're supposed to learn to play the piano or the violin or the trumpet. And take voice lessons, and we all hated it, and we didn't learn it, and that's why symphony orchestras can't get musicians today. But nowadays, kids are practicing their music without being told to do so by daddy. In fact, daddy is telling them to shut the damn thing off. then that's good. Now, guitar is not as noble and high as the violin, but have you noticed the number of people who are decorating their own houses? The interest up here in John Mockestad, people follow him around. And, my wife fills our house with painting, sculpture, and she's not that untypical. Now, I think we are learning. I think there is a kind of a cultural revolution that's being taken. There are other things happening. The new interest in community, reflecting the popularity of sensitivity training. I'm not saying any of these things are great. I think there are superficialities and trivialities in all of these things, but these are some of the forces that I think are altering our modes of perception. And they will alter our style of life eventually if we're given the time. I'm afraid that there aren't, you know, no, not that. I'm afraid, and I thought I heard other people saying this, that the number of opportunities for people to find satisfaction in jobs well done, that they can also do well, are diminishing. See, in the days when people, when there's lots of room to make things, and there are a lot of things need to be made, and they can be fairly rough-hewn, there are more opportunities for a person to find meaning in a job well done. When there are a lot of essential tasks that have to be organized and administered, again, there's more scope for this. But if it's true that, you know, we could run the country, and I think this is an exaggeration in many ways, but that we could get the essential tasks done with 10% of the labor force, the rest of us could play golf, well, then all the golfers are going to have to find something else that's meaningful, and golf probably isn't it. It's not that people can't find satisfaction in job.
If we had a problem with finding out what to do with the surplus golfers, then what to do with the surplus unemployed?
Well, the golfers were unemployed by my metaphor.
By connotation, the golfer, the man or the woman, has the wherewithal to go play golf.
Well, yeah, I was assuming that we would do something like he says, that if we become so productive indeed that we don't have to worry about getting more things, although we're going to be worrying a long time about the services, as he pointed out, then we will be able to give people sort of guaranteed income, income supplements, negative income tax, and so on, so people will have income. But I think we would still be faced with the question, what will people do with this income? If the only things from which people really can derive satisfaction are the things that whose production pollutes the environment, you're going to be in trouble.
You're going right back to exactly the same point and the problem that Will was at this point, and what needs to be done here. What is required here to keep this from being a problem? What is required here to more or less normalize the disparity? It's a change in the value system. They have to come about. This is where the change has got to be. And I don't see the problem with today's generation, and yet with ours that are coming up, them adapting to, emboldening a new set of values consistent with accepted Christian norms or any other set of norms that want to be brought in and compared against. They can adapt and change what used to be good in itself. You're now learning to do it if it's enjoyed or useful. I mean, hard work for the sake of, I mean, it was good. Hard work itself, whether you're working on the wrong thing or not, made no difference. If you're working hard, it was good. Now you should be working on those things that are good. again, quote, unquote. But I think it's back in the meeting between the bodies. What is the philosophy?